broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Everybody loved Chick Lorimer in our town. Far off, everybody loved her. So we all love a wild girl keeping a hold on a dream she wants. Nobody knows now where Chick Lorimer went. Nobody knows why she packed her trunk. A few old things and is gone. Gone with her little chin thrust ahead of her, and her soft hair blowing careless from under a wide hat. Dancer, singer, a laughing, passionate lover. Were there 10 men or 100 hunting Chick? Were there 5 men or 50 with aching hearts? Everybody loved Chick Lorimer. Nobody knows where she's gone. Carl Sandburg. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're pleased to welcome poet Sue Ellen Thompson to our studio today to discuss her latest book of poetry, They. Sue Ellen, I think it was back in March that you were first on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. So let me say welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to have you here again.
Thank you, Hal. I'm happy to be here.
Sue Ellen Thompson's poems have been read on National Public Radio by Garrison Keillor, been featured in U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser's nationally syndicated newspaper column, and received numerous awards, including the 1986 Samuel French Morse Prize, the 2003 Pablo Neruda Prize, and the Maryland Author Award. She is author of 5 books: The Leaving, New and Selected Poems, The Golden Hour, both of which were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Sue Ellen is also the editor of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry that is now being used in college classrooms across the country. Sue Ellen, you've just published a new book of poetry called They. Please tell us about your new book.
Well, Hal, most of the poems in They are the ones that I wrote and shoved in a file, never intending to share them with anyone, to be honest. But as the years progressed, I came to recognize that these were, in fact, the poems closest to my heart, the ones that dealt with the most difficult subject matter and the relationships that mattered to me most.
You write a lot about your family, and these poems are no exception to that. Tell us a little bit, though, Sue Ellen. You say these poems were the more difficult ones that you had. And yet, as I've read your book, there seems to be a structure to this book. Before we get into the poems, tell us a little bit about the structure of the book. What are we going to find when we open this book?
Well, the idea I had in organizing the poems within the manuscript was that the extent and the depth of the subject matter would be revealed gradually as you moved through the poems. This is very much a book that is meant to be read from beginning to end, rather than just having a reader dip in and pull out a poem here and there. And I wanted what was going on in my child's life to sort of dawn on the reader gradually, the way it did on me. And I didn't want to lay it all out in the first section.
That's exactly what I found, and a very interesting structure to the book. Indeed, the majority of the poems, though, are clearly about your relationship with your daughter and her relationship with her grandfather. In fact, Thomason's postcards in the book to her grandfather, I think, are a literary treasure. And we'll talk about those postcards a little later. But your daughter identifies herself and is identified as transgender. What does transgender mean? I guess let me clarify a little mm-hmm. bit. I mean, more specifically, what does it mean for your daughter?
Mm-hmm. Transgender is an all-encompassing term for anyone whose birth gender does not match their gender identity, who they feel they are inside. It has nothing to do with sexual orientation, which is a common mistake people make. It's an entirely separate issue. And my child, now in her 30s, defines herself actually as genderqueer, which is a term that indicates she does not subscribe to conventional gender distinctions and sees herself as occupying some kind of middle ground or a place on the spectrum between male and female.
I think your poems, though, point to a particular persona that Thomason exemplifies, mm-hmm. and again, we'll talk about that as we read your poems. But it seems to me, Thomason had a very, very, very early idea of her difference, mm-hmm. and that difference was confusing to you mm-hmm. Early on, but we get that hint, I think, in a poem called A Birthday Gift, and I wondered if you wouldn't mind reading that poem for us.
I'd be happy to. A Birthday Gift. There was a children's clothing store in town, and when I took her there to buy an outfit for her second birthday, she walked right past the dresses I pulled off the rack, their small yokes choked with smocking, and with the single-minded grace of the athlete she'd become, went straight to a pair of gray wool knickers. Charmed by this display of independence at such an age, I picked out a navy hair ribbon, which my daughter promptly wore around her pale neck, knotted like a tie.
Well, even if she wasn't clear mm-hmm. at that tender age about who she was, she knew.
She knew, and you didn't. And I didn't. I look back on it, and it's so obvious. But, you know, this was 30-some-odd years ago. I'd never heard the term transgender. It just never occurred to me that she was anything other than an adorable tomboy.
So this struggle that you had to come to terms mm-hmm. with this persona of your daughter mm-hmm. or her personal mm-hmm. Being is echoed in the poems that we read in this book. But again, Thomason, knowing who she was, I think, is reflected also to a degree in the poem Echo Rock.
Yes.
Read the poem Echo Rock that you wrote for us.
I might say that just by way of explanation, my parents retired to a farm in New Hampshire called Echo Rock Farm, and it had a little mound, I don't know, a few hundred feet from the house, and if you stood on top of that mound, you could actually hear an echo. It would bounce off the barn or the house or whatever. Echo Rock. When my daughter was young, my father built a hut for her on Echo Rock, the granite mound for which the farm was named and from which, if she faced the house, she could pitch her name and have it flung right back. Made from barnboard scraps, the weathered gray that characterized the foreshortened days of a New Hampshire winter, it had a single window facing north and a door that she could padlock. I hear her still, from the clump of underbrush that kept her refuge and its secrets hidden, at the end of a day when it appeared that she had played contentedly alone. Thomason, she called repeatedly, as if there were another of her, and it was time now for them both to hurry home.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. When did you first begin to realize that Thomason was different and that she was not, in fact, going to turn into the little girl that you expected when, as you say in one of your other poems, the nurse handed the little package to you when she was born?
Right. Well, it probably wasn't until after high school and college, maybe in her early 20s. High school, even college, are times of great change when kids try on all different kinds of identities, and hers never wavered from nursery school right through to her 20s. Nothing ever actually changed, and I think it was then that I realized this was who she is.
Well, there's another poem called At St. Paul's School for Girls, and that had to have given you a pretty clear hint that things were not going down the regularly scheduled path that parents expect. Read that poem for us, if you would.
I should explain that I did spend a day, not that long ago, a few years ago, at St. Paul's School for Girls outside of Baltimore. And while I was there, a teacher brought this student to me and suggested I talk to her, and I had no idea why. That's the background. At St. Paul's School for Girls. Like a girl, arms crossed against her chest, not about to let herself be dragged off to young womanhood, but like a boy with her splayed-kneed slouch and fitted cap of hair. A teacher brought her to me, wanted us to talk. I chattered aimlessly about myself and poetry until it came to me. Here was my child at 17, estranged from her own kind. But I was not her mother, and she was not my child. So we just sat there, looking at each other miserably, waiting for the years to pass so she could go to college, graduate, and find a small community of peers who would accept what she'd become, so I could have a grown child who'd come back to me, arms tattooed and outstretched.
So you say in this poem, but I was not her mother and she was not my child. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was a student. I'd never set
this
eyes on before.
This was not Thomason.
This was not Thomason. This was a student at St. Paul's School for Girls. And I couldn't figure out why they wanted me to talk to her until I spent a little time with her and realized how miserable and uncomfortable she was with who and what her parents were encouraging her to be. And then I recognized what was going on.
In your own family.
Yes.
Well, Thomason to me is a person who knows who she is.
And absolutely.
There's a wonderful poem in the book that I will confess, Sue Ellen, is my favorite poem for a lot of reasons. But I would and to me a poem that says an awful lot about who Thomason is. Would you read the paper dress for us?
The paper dress. She never went to high school proms and showed no interest in boys. But the night of the Christmas dance, she came downstairs wearing a paper lawn and leaf bag on which she'd painted the curvaceous body of the woman she had no intention of becoming, wearing a snug white dress with bra straps showing and an inch-wide zipper running from her cross-hatched cleavage to her fishnet knees. The teacher who was chaperoning wouldn't let her in, although her friends were wearing strapless, backless, asymmetric hems that clung discreetly to one ankle before soaring up the opposite thigh. My daughter bit down hard on her own anger, looked the teacher in the eye, and slowly, stiffly started walking backwards to the door, her middle finger raised behind the paper dress's hourglass waist.
A person, for me, fighting to preserve the identity that she has chosen, mm-hmm. and refusing to fit the mold,
yes.
that was designed for her. Did she come downstairs on her way to the dance with this outfit on? Did you see her in this outfit? Is that where this poem comes from?
Yes. We have photographs of her in this outfit. Not exactly what I had in mind, but then again, she'd never dressed in the way I thought she should or would as she was growing up. But it was one of those big, square, stiff paper bags that we used to fill with leaves every fall. She was always an artist. She could paint and draw beautifully. So on the front of the bag, she had this curvaceous outline. And her head was sticking out of the top, and her arms were sticking out of the side.
And what did you think as you saw your daughter leaving in this outfit?
I thought it was funny and clever. That's why I took all the pictures of her. I thought, this is great. And the next thing I know, we have a call from the school saying, come get her. She's not dressed appropriately. And I was as outraged about that as she was, because she was covered from her chin to her knees. She was covered in a paper bag. And I know what those other girls were wearing and what they were getting away with.
Which was not completely covered.
No. No. So I was with her on that one. We went into the principal's office the next week and supported her.
And how did she respond to your support?
I don't remember getting encouragement or gratitude at the time, no.
At the time. Why do you think this is a piece of performance art, mm-hmm. is what she was doing. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the school reacted so strongly to this piece of performance art?
Well, this was, let me think, this would have been 1996 or 97. I'm not sure this would happen nowadays. I really don't. Even though she went to a high school that was like an art school, really, for high school age kids, most of the teachers and administrators were still fairly conservative and held fairly conventional ideas about appropriate dress and behavior. I bet it's different now.
What do you think Thomason was saying with this piece of art?
I am not going to be who you think I should be.
And
I can put it on like a bag, but I can tear it off.
Oh, that's a beautiful image. This is quite a young lady, if
a young person,
if I can use this term.
No,
that's exactly right. I stand corrected. A young person. So, Ellen, for me, the book is primarily about two voices. The first voice is yours, mm-hmm. in your poems, and in that voice, you give us a picture of your daughter. Mm-hmm. You describe her for us, and almost all of those descriptions run to how different she is, mm-hmm. and your reaction to that difference, and also the relationship she has with mm-hmm. her grandfather, which is quite different than mm-hmm. the one she has with you. So I think one part of the charm of the book is that we get a picture of Thomason mm-hmm. from your poems, and then you included in the book these postcards, mm-hmm. the postcards that Thomason wrote over years,
over a 10-year period, yeah,
to her grandfather, mm-hmm. and in those postcards, we hear another voice, mm-hmm. and we hear a voice that defines actually someone else, mm-hmm. another person, not so much the person that you give us in right. in the poems, but a person who speaks mm-hmm. with her own voice. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of the postcards and, okay. and the relationship Thomason had with your father, mm-hmm. her grandfather.
Yeah, she wrote these postcards starting right after my mother died, and my father lived for another 10 years beyond that. So he was alone in this New Hampshire farmhouse, and she was sending him postcards about maybe one a month in which she chronicled her daily activities and her travels and whatnot. And my father would always read these postcards to me. I knew they existed. He would save them up and give them to me whenever I came up to visit. And then before he died, he gave me another stack of 25 or so. And when I put the manuscript together, it was already largely in place, but I felt that something was missing. And you have hit on exactly what was missing, which was Thomason's voice. I mean, everything was through me. And that was so complicated and so fraught by the difficulties we had been through since she was a teenager. And what I wanted to show was her uncomplicated relationship with her grandfather. And I felt that the best way to do that was by using her own words, as seen in these postcards.
Well, we see in these postcards a beautiful voice, and I'd like to ask you if you would read the poem called Postcards.
Okay. Postcards. Postmarked Ann Arbor, Fort Wayne, Memphis, and a dozen other places I never knew she'd visited. My daughter's postcards to her widowed grandfather were the only way I had of finding out what she was up to during those years when her phone calls thinned to almost nothing. He would leave them on the nightstand in the bedroom where I slept when I was visiting, and I would read them, row after row of minuscule block letters, pausing patiently before the fenced-off plot she'd set aside for sheltering his name and address, just before I went to sleep. She often signed them, "Thinking of you, Pop," and I did not for one minute doubt which shelf he occupied in the library of her affections. "And how did that make you, her mother, feel?" a shrink would no doubt ask, and I would have to answer that it made me happy, happier, I think, than if those cards had been addressed to me. Here was a man who'd waited 19 years for a grandson, who had kept his wishes silent as 6 granddaughters were born. Here was a man who liked to spend a summer day fishing lazily along the Merrimack, winter weekends stacking cordwood, and here was a child who wanted to be at his side doing what he did. They seemed to have an understanding. She would give him all the love that she could spare for generations preceding her own, and in return, he'd never say a word about her tattoos or her piercings or her boyish haircut or ask her why she hid her breasts and let her mustache show. He would simply think of her as the grandson he'd been waiting for, and she would always think of him as the man she wanted to be like when she was old and had no grandson of her own.
When did you write that poem, Sue Ellen?
I wrote it not that long ago, actually, long after the postcards were all written and my father was dead and they were in my possession. And I felt that the manuscript that was gradually taking shape needed an introductory poem to the postcard poems.
Well, it's a beautiful poem, a beautiful piece of work. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll hear the voice of Thomason in her postcards to her grandfather. You don't want to miss Thomason's postcards. Please stay with us.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask why. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've
feel.
Had to believe in impossible
infinite
things.
Infinite possibility, that sense of potential. And I realize
and we've had to refuse
persist.
To fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSDL.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. I'm talking to Sue Ellen Thomason about her new book of poetry entitled They. Sue Ellen, let's hear Thomason's voice now in these postcards to her grandfather. Would you read, for instance, the postcard entitled Lakota Wolf Preserve, Columbia, New Jersey?
Sure. Hey, Pop. I went on a 24-hour getaway with some friends to the Delaware Water Gap, 2 hours north of Philly. We floated down the river in tubes all afternoon, camped for the night, then got up early for the Wolf Watch at a place nearby where 25 timber, tundra, and Arctic wolves now live. There were bobcats who'd been someone's pets and two red foxes. All were either born in captivity or rescued from roadside attractions, so they weren't afraid of humans. I was thinking about that cougar you once spotted in New Hampshire. Next time you see him, tell him there's a home for him here in New Jersey. Isn't that where you spent your wild youth? I miss our early morning walks. Love, Thomason.
So Ellen, your daughter is a beautiful writer. In her own, she's a beautiful writer. What is your feeling about this particular postcard? When you read this postcard, what do you find here?
Well, I'm amazed at how, and this was true of almost all of them, how she was able to relate, you know, to bring my dad into her life, you know, by the New Jersey connection, by the wildlife walks they used to take. Many of them end with a little piece of health-related advice because my father could have cared less what he ate or drank, and my daughter was vegan and very concerned about his health. And they're not just about her. She is concerned about him, and that comes through in almost everyone.
The health food aspect, she's very interested in health food and so forth, I think you've told me.
Yes, absolutely. She's worked at a very well-established old food co-op in West Philadelphia. She's worked there for years.
Well, I can't help, as I read your description of Thomason in your poems. And then as I began to read these postcards, it pardon me, but it was almost as though I saw two different people here. And all of a sudden, I see this voice. Mm-hmm. I see this person mm-hmm. with such softness and such loving care mm-hmm. to her grandfather, because it's exactly as you say, it was not all about her. Mm-hmm. It was about him and about their relationship. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you that in this particular postcard that we have read first, I can't help equating Thomason with the refuge she found in Columbia, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Born in captivity to her gender. She says, "I was thinking about that cougar you once spotted in New Hampshire. Next time you see him, tell him there's a home for him here in New Jersey." Mm-hmm. Born in captivity to the wrong gender, it seems that her refuge mm-hmm. may in fact be her grandfather.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right about that. As I said before, her relationship with him was so uncomplicated, quite the opposite of what she had with me. I can't even begin to describe the difficulties we have been through, although I absolutely support who she is. And I think these postcards show her in the most true and positive light. But I should also mention that she's not happy there in the book, you know? And I know this is not a problem that is uncommon among writers who write about family, but it never crossed my mind that she wouldn't be thrilled to have this wonderful relationship portrayed in her own words. But apparently she's not.
No, she. Well, I think that all of us, mm-hmm. to some degree or another, have rebelled against our parents mm-hmm. because we all have the need to establish our own identity.
Right.
And we are going to do that. Mm-hmm. And thus, it probably starts at around 5 years old. And we begin to set up that barrier that says, "I am not you. And I am not going to be you."
Mm-hmm.
And what we have, it seems to me, from reading your poems and reading Thomason's postcards, is a person who says, "I am going to be mm-hmm. this person."
Right.
And one of the ways in which she identifies herself is to say, "It is not you."
Absolutely.
But that also is kind of a normal part of the process of growing
mm-hmm.
up.
Mm-hmm.
What we're always rebelling against the mold that mm-hmm. other people try to put us in.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomason is just at the far end.
Yes.
Of that spectrum.
Yes.
Now. And right. So it must be very difficult still to deal with that kind of I'll call it rebellion,
mm-hmm.
that I can identify myself partly as not being you.
Right, and in her case, wholly almost as not being me. The only parts of myself I see in my child, maybe her writing ability, because I barely had to change a comma on these postcards. They were so perfectly expressed and punctuated and spelled. I thought, well, there's something maybe she got from me.
Frankly, I wouldn't dare change a comma or a word in these. Well, you talk about the difference, and your poems go to the difference, and Thomason's actions also a lot go to the difference. But in reading these postcards, and I'm going to ask you to read in just a minute another one called Vintage Philadelphia. But before we get to that one, I found so many places where the two of you are similar. And I just jotted down the similarities, and I'd like to ask you to respond to that. First of all, and clearly all I know of Thomason is what you have written and reading the postcards. So, but clearly you are both articulate. You are both very verbal and very articulate. You are both beautiful writers. So there is that similarity, because these postcards truly are beautiful.
I agree, and
your poetry notwithstanding, you are both very strong people. Just from knowing you and reading your poetry, you are a very strong person, and you are both very sensitive. Oh, I would hate to say how sensitive you must be. I could talk to your husband about how sensitive you are. And we know from the poems and the postcards of Thomason's sensitivity, and you're both compassionate.
Well, I'm glad to hear we have something in common. I mean, you're seeing it perhaps from an outsider's perspective,
very
which
much
makes
so,
it
yes.
easier.
Yeah.
I just see not me everywhere I look.
Right.
You know.
But there is so much of you in these postcards and in this young person. Well, read Vintage Philadelphia for us if you would.
Postcard, Vintage Philadelphia, dear Pop. I had a great time visiting last week with you and your two sisters. Anissa and I spent the whole ride home talking about how much fun it was hanging out with people in their 80s. Aunt Ruthie pinched Anissa's arm and said it felt like it was made of rubber. Guess there aren't too many young people where she lives. And Aunt Connie asked if I cut my hair this way on purpose. She's hilarious. Anyway, after listening to so many friends' post-holiday complaints about their cold, offensive older relatives, I feel particularly grateful that I have such energetic, charming ones. Stay warm and eat some vegetables. Love, Thomason.
Oh, beautiful. You can see a beautiful and a sensitive and compassionate person revealed in these postcards. At least that's what I see. What do you see when you read these postcards again?
Well, I see what I saw when I first read them, but now that I have made them into poems, which primarily consists of building in line breaks and being more sensitive to the rhythms of each line and that sort of thing, I see actually more of the artist in her. And perhaps less just the grandchild. I really do see the artist in her when I read these. And they were beautiful little creations. As I said, her handwriting was all in capital letters, and she fit more on a postcard than most of us could fit on a typed page. It was amazing how much information she conveyed. Sometimes I couldn't fit it all in a poem.
So, Ellen, there's a poem, there's a postcard in here about tomatoes. Is it possible for you to find
it? Yeah, about the tomato palooza. Postcard, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Pop. I'm on a road trip with my friend Anissa. Yesterday we went to Tomato Palooza, a festival of heirloom tomatoes, table after table of them. You could pick one up and eat it like an apple. I remember the tomato plants you always grew in a whiskey barrel on the patio at Echo Rock. Have you planted them again this year? I can picture you about to take a bite of the summer's first BLT. Nothing like a ripe tomato, that's what you always say. I'll call you when I'm back in Philly. Love, Thomason.
Again, just a beautiful voice. Tell us about your grandfather.
My father?
Your father. Now, yes. Yeah, Thomason's grandfather. Yeah. Tell us about your father, and why do you think they developed this relationship? Mm-hmm.
Well, my father was an ex-POW in World War II in Germany. He flew a bomber. He was a pilot who had been shot down and taken prisoner. He was a very traditional conservative guy, very much a man of his generation. And it just amazed me that he could have this highly unconventional grandchild and accept almost without question who and what she was. I mean, the only thing he ever said to me, he said, Thomason's probably gay, isn't she? And I let it go at that. I said, yeah, I think so. And that was the sum total of our conversation on the subject. I didn't think he could get his head around the whole transgender concept at age 91. So that was in the last year of his life, and he loved who she was, and I just didn't see any need to complicate that.
Well, when he died, Thomason came in and selected. You gave her the opportunity to select items.
Yes.
Furniture,
mm-hmm.
paintings,
mm-hmm.
whatever,
mm-hmm.
from the
mm-hmm.
house
mm-hmm.
in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And she selected some different, well, she's a different person.
So, yes, once so again, she not what I expected.
So she selected, again, not what you expected,
mm-hmm.
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
But you wrote a poem about her selections. Mm-hmm. Would you read that poem?
Okay. Inheritance. After the funeral, I told my daughter she could choose what she wanted from her grandfather's New Hampshire farmhouse. She took the yellowed handkerchiefs with which he'd wiped his brow when mowing the lawn those 30 summers after his retirement. A leather belt, well-worn but stiff, from hanging where he'd abandoned it, when nothing but suspenders could keep his pants from falling off his ancient hips. And the pajama bottoms he had worn for what turned out to be his last 8 days and nights. As I watched her fold and pack her small inheritance in a grocery bag, I asked, "Isn't there something else?" thinking of a rug or piece of furniture. She went directly to the small spice chest that had hung on the wall for 50 years. Opening each of the miniature drawers and peering inside, she said, "Just this," and pulled out a campaign-style button that said, "I flew a B-24, which she pinned to her stocking cap as she boarded the train for home.
Mm-hmm. You, when we were chatting earlier, you had said that these items she took figured prominently in some of her more recent artwork,
mm-hmm.
that in a style of drawing that she has returned to.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, if you would.
Yes, she did a series of very detailed pen and ink drawings of her grandfather's belongings, objects that she associated him with, including his baseball hat that said 449th Bomb Group on it, his underwear neatly folded in thirds the way he had been taught to do it during when he was in the Army, his belt, the very same material in a way I dealt with in my poetry. Of course, I would never mention that to her. I think she thinks of her grandfather and these objects as belonging to her.
Well, we can see that they do, and she's appropriated them not only as items in a top drawer, but also in her art and in her expression of what her life is all about. And that's a beautiful expression of this young lady. Yeah. Again, a different picture of Thomason than we have in these poems. We had talked once before, Sue Ellen, you and I, about tone in poetry. And you defined tone at the time as attitude.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is, first of all, the attitude of these poems? What's your tone in these poems that you're expressing?
Boy, that is a really hard question, because tone in the poems written from my perspective comes out of who I am. And, boy, you might be able to describe it better than I could. I would say the tone would be part puzzlement, part sadness, part loss, and part trying to understand and to encompass.
That's interesting, because of your challenge to try to understand poem tone and attitude, I asked myself what the tone of these poems, of your poems, is. Mm-hmm. What's the attitude that is expressed?
Yeah, how would you describe it? I'd be curious. How do you perceive the tone?
I'm going to tell you how I perceive it, and I'm going to ask you to respond to it.
Okay.
I see the tone as longing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's another word that I can absolutely identify with. Absolutely. You know, me longing to have the same relationship that my father has. And I will probably never know how that is, because I probably will never have a grandchild.
Well, that was my other question, which is, what are you longing for?
I guess just peace and reconciliation. That's all.
Yeah.
That's all. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very good. Would you agree that the poems express, that the attitude of the poems is a kind of longing, or do you think no?
No, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that.
Well, it seems to me that Thomason Parnes knows who she is. And I hope she reads this book, and I hope she is able to come to accept this book, and that, for me, playing a little microphone psychology here, that to me would express her own confidence in being the person she has chosen to be, and I think I get that from her postcards. So let me ask you the same question again. What do you think is the tone of these postcards? What's the attitude in these postcards?
Loving.
Yeah.
I can't think of another word. It's just, they're loving.
Yeah.
You know, they're cheerful, they're upbeat. They reach out to him. They call on memory, things they've done together. They show how much he has taught her through their walks in New Hampshire and identifying birds and fish and whatnot, wildlife. I just think they're very loving.
So, Thomason came to see your father when he was dying. And you've written a poem about that visit of Thomason to her grandfather, the last, I think it was the last visit that she made. And I think that poem is a little different, because the poem does not talk about Thomason being different.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
It talks about her relationship to her grandfather, mm-hmm. and it's almost a postcard
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
by itself. Would you read that poem sure. for us?
My daughter visits her grandfather during his final illness. He keeps asking me, when is she coming? When will she be here? And I keep saying she's on her way from Philadelphia, probably in Connecticut now, in Manchester, barely a half hour away, and there she is in the door. He doesn't see what I see, a girl, boy, woman, man with a sparse mustache, with a chest made flat with thrift shop pants hanging off her ass. He sees his grandchild, who climbs on his bed and reads him the get well cards and newspaper headlines, spooning egg into his near toothless mouth, patting down the thin hair that the pillow pushed up, telling him easily and repeatedly what she hasn't told me in years.
It's just the literary quality of your poetry, Sue Ellen, is a little overwhelming. There is nothing to choose an academic term for poetry. There is nothing oblique mm-hmm. about this poem and about many mm-hmm. of your poems. For me, they are linear, they are straight, and they go straight to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
And one can't help but be moved by these poems. One of the most moving, I think, of your poems is called July 17. And I wondered if you would read July 17 for us, because I think this really captures the essence of who you are in this book anyway.
Mm-hmm. And it's also very much an Eastern Shore poem,
okay.
because I was taking this nap by the edge of the water. July 17th, on a wooden chaise by the water's edge, I dozed in red, forgetting that my mother was dead, that my daughter had decided she was a man, and that I was living apart from my husband. I was reading a book I'd already read, which made it easier to put aside, which made it easier to close my eyes and dismiss my own misfortunes. The wind lifted the heads of grasses bowed by the heat, like forgotten wishes revived by memory, then left them listless again. I did the same. One by one, I summoned my obsessions, then waved them off. A restless bee nursed on the clover beneath my feet, but I let this sweetness elude me. For hours that seamless afternoon, I drifted, so far from familiar shores, it was as if I'd fallen overboard and no one noticed. My reward was respite from both fear and dread, but also from joy. It was a kind of death, this sleep. I was a chord struck once, dissipating in the summer air. I awoke to my neighbor in her yard somewhere, calling, "Shadow, shadow," nothing more.
Nothing more. Such power in this work. Two beautiful voices in this book, your own voice and the voice of your daughter, Thomason. It's just an amazing, I think, piece of work. Let's close with one more poem in Philadelphia, if you don't mind.
In Philadelphia. There's dark fur curled above her sock and a shadow on her upper lip. She's let her eyebrows grow back in, and she's cut her own hair so it hangs in painted strands across her forehead. But as we're walking down the street, she lets my steps fall in with hers, Emboldened then, I swing my arm around and let it settle lightly on her shoulders. Joy like a torrent rushes in, for here I am in Philadelphia, on my way to a restaurant with my 28-year-old child.
Wonderful. So there is some opportunity for for a relationship
a
here.
A moment that, here that and there.
Is, that is not that is not hostile.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that this will be your last book of poetry.
You probably did.
You've mentioned that a couple of times now. I don't know if it's in exasperation of how difficult this book has been to put together, or if there is some other reason why you feel that that you will not publish another book of poetry, which would be a great loss for us, quite frankly. But why do you feel that that this is perhaps your last book of poetry?
Well, it took me so many years to write, and I had so many false starts, and I've already absorbed a fair amount of criticism from certain individuals for being so open and so honest about something so personal. And for right now, anyway, it just doesn't feel like something I want to rush out and do again. But I reserve the right to change my mind.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we certainly hope you will change your mind. This book, Sue Ellen, where can our listeners buy this book?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com. Our local bookstore, Mystery Loves Company in Oxford, Maryland, is carrying it. And you can also go to my publisher's website, Turning Point Books.
Well, Sue Ellen, thank you for joining us today. Your book is truly a pleasure. Okay, all you writers out there, screw up your courage, look inside yourselves with an unflinching eye, and with words well chosen, remind us all of our common bond. Thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.